From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, End Times with Joel Richardson. But here's what's happening. Well, we had a lot of snow tonight, and it's been cold in the St. Louis area, and protesters slowed down over the last couple days what they've been doing. They did sing some songs, but there was pretty calm. Actually, protesters blocked a couple roads. There were more problems outside of the Ferguson area in other states, like in California near Los Angeles, where a lot of people were arrested there. You know, what's happening in this situation, again, all started because of a police officer who was not indicted in the shooting death of an 18-year-old unarmed youth here in the St. Louis area. This has all started where real protesters were concerned and did what they did. But then all of a sudden, you had the criminal element come in, and they started looting, burning buildings, and creating all kinds of mayhem. Those are the ones who are destroying true, honest-to-goodness protest. And police have gotten tough. There are 2,200 National Guardsmen, along with a full force of police officers all over the St. Louis area. But this has festered around the country as well. We do have to, of course, I think, learn from this, but I do believe it'll slow down. A massive sunspot capable of knocking out communications and the power is once again aligning with Earth. Hey, we've been talking about this. Renamed Active Region 12192 because it's a sunspot that has come around a second time, and it's due to come into alignment in a few days. Sunspots of this kind kick out solar flares that can create what's called a coronal mass ejection that flings hot bursts of millions of tons of highly charged particles into space at 4 million miles an hour. If the sunspot is aimed at Earth at the time of the CME, it would interfere enough with the magnetic poles to seriously damage satellites and electrical power grids, as we've been talking about. The damage could include all unprotected electronics and automated control systems that operate life-sustaining critical infrastructures. William Forstchen, author of One Second After, with us. Well, here we go again. We've been talking about it, William, and, well, maybe it could happen.
This one's spooky. This is, as you know, the second time around that this sunspot has been staring straight at us. I feel like we're looking down the barrel of a shotgun, and statistically, we're going to get it. If not this time, eventually it will happen. It will happen within our lifetimes. We
need to keep kicking up the dust and get some legislators to pass some kind of law to get the grid insulated, Bill.
Well, you know, you hit it. It's like we're staring at somebody with a loaded weapon, and we don't have any kind of body armor on at all. Sooner or later, we're going to be it.
No doubt about it. Have a great Thanksgiving, William. Appreciate
you too. God bless.
William Forstchen, author of course, One Second After. United Kingdom researchers received rich data from the Comet lander just before its power died. The power is out. Scientists say they detected what might be complex carbon compounds on the surface of the comet. The craft landed 2 weeks ago. The U.S. Geological Survey has confirmed that another earthquake has occurred near Texas. Initial reports say the magnitude of the quake, 2.7. Something's happening over there. Snowy weather along the East Coast has disrupted one of the busiest travel days ahead of the country's Thanksgiving holiday. More than 400 flights have been canceled. Thousands have been delayed. 12 inches of snow forecast in the Northeast. Jeez. Long-derided saturated fats associated with an array of health problems such as heart disease caught a break when research has revealed their intake could be doubled or even nearly tripled without driving up their level in a person's blood. Carbohydrates, meanwhile, are associated with heightened levels of a fatty acid linked to increased risk for diabetes and heart disease, according to the same study. Dr. John McDougall, who was just on the program with me, author of The Starch Solution. John, I want your reaction to that story about carbohydrates. What do you think?
Well, I think industry has struck again, another advertisement. This particular study was, I mean, seriously, George, all you have to do is a free study from Public Library of Science. You can download it. You just look in the left-hand column. You look at the funding source. It's funded by the dairy, the beef, the egg industry, as well as the Atkins Foundation. It's just a pitch to sell more meat, more dairy, more eggs to the public. Unfortunately, this leads to death. and heart disease. And there have been four major studies published in the last 3 years, George. I mean, the thing that your consumer, your listener cares about, they don't care about what happens when you change the amount of sugar or carbohydrate or fat or so on in the diet to some fatty acid in their blood. Very confusing research paper, by the way. What your listener is concerned about is whether or not they're going to die or suffer a heart attack. And there have been four major analyses done since 2010 addressing the subject, what happens to people who are on high saturated fat, low carbohydrate diets. In each one of the studies, the Annals of Internal Medicine, the British Medical Journal, PLLOS, Public Library of Science 1, and most recently the Journal of American Heart Association have shown that when you follow these diets, you increase your risks of death and heart disease. That's what the consumer cares about. That's what consistently the research says. There's nothing to the opposite. Advertisement, George. That's it.
All right, John, have a great Thanksgiving. I really appreciate it. The Siege of Bastogne was an engagement in December of 1944 between American and German forces at the Belgian town of Bastogne as part of the larger Battle of the Bulge. I want you to listen in.
Eisenhower made two critical decisions on the 17th. One, Ike ordered more than 11,000 trucks of the Red Ball Express that had been hauling supplies in from Normandy Beach to drop whatever they were doing and start hauling his reinforcements to the Ardennes. Two, Eisenhower declared that Bastogne would be the place that has to be held no matter what. He ordered the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions be sent in to hold it. For the first time, because of bad weather, the Screaming Eagles went into combat the old-fashioned way, on wheels.
We were jammed into cattle trucks, really, as they call them. These are big, huge semis with no cover on them, just the steel sides. 501 was the lead unit of the 101st. We pulled out ahead of the others. As I recall, it was about 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon when we bugged out of there. I forget how many 200 and some miles it was. Terribly uncomfortable. And our regiment was the first one to move into Bastogne, and the 1st Battalion went in first, and we came in second.
When the men of the 101st Airborne arrived at Bastogne on December 19th, they were stunned at the sight before them. Marching down the road, heading west, were the defeated troops of the 28th Division. Many had thrown away their weapons. Some were in a hysterical panic to head west away from the oncoming Germans.
We had turned everything in and was just waiting to see what we're doing, and then the Battle of the Bulge broke through. And I never saw that many semi-trailers, the Air Force, and they brought truckloads of equipment and just dumped it on the ground and said, you all have been there before, get what you need. There wasn't any checking out what weapons, you know. And my guys all had Tommy guns, and we checked out the equipment we needed, and we put us on trucks, and we had a convoy going towards Bastogne. And it was kind of scary because here we are going into combat, and the roads were covered with American troops going to the rear, you know.
Well, the siege lasted from December 20th to the 27th, 1944, when the besieged American forces were relieved by elements of General George Patton's 3rd Army. It happened a long time ago, but I don't want you to forget. In a moment, No Greater Value, Jerome Corsi's latest book, No Greater Valor, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jerry Corsi with us. I'm proud to announce, by the way, that his book, No Greater Valor, is coming out right now, and we're the first major interview with Jerry. He, of course, received his Ph.D. in political science from Harvard University. Writes, he's a columnist for WND.com, editor of Red Alert as well, a global financial strategies newsletter, and several of his books out there, Hunting Hitler, Who Really Killed Kennedy, Atomic Iran, Black Gold Stranglehold, you name it, he's done it. We're going to talk about this incredible story of the Siege of Bastogne and the miracle that sealed the Allied victory. Jerry, this is an amazing piece of work by you, by the way. Well done.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate that. I've worked on this for years, and it's a story I've always wanted to tell. I'm really pleased it's coming out at Thanksgiving. It'll be in the stores now, and I think it's a great Christmas book as it celebrates this tremendous Battle of the Bulge, which happened 70 years ago in December. So the 70th anniversary celebrating the 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles, which fought at Bastogne, and other divisions like the 10th Armored. One regiment of the 10th Armored broke through and was also at Bastogne in December 1944.
Well, you know, I was weighing, too, when you were writing the book and you were talking about it, when you were on our program, just giving us some special news segments about what was happening in the Middle East. And I kept saying, this is an event happened 70 years ago. Most of my listeners probably weren't even born, most of them. And so how does that affect them? And then, you know, as I read your advanced reader's copy, Jerry, and I realized that it was battles like this by Americans and Canadians and Brits that literally saved us from being taken over by the Nazis.
Well, that's right, George. And the other thing about the battle, I mean, I dedicated the book to my father. He fought in World War II, and what impressed me so much as a kid, talking to my dad and the other men who had fought in World War II, was that when they talk about Bastogne, they felt like that God had intervened, that this was somehow, you know, miracles. They pointed to events in the battle. And, you know, my dad was a tough guy. He was a labor union public relations head for the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen. It was in the 1950s, 1960s, and the men who fought in World War II were hardened battle veterans. And to hear these guys talk about that God had actually sealed their victory, it really made an impression on me as a kid. And as I studied the battle as an adult, I found that in the testimonies after the battle and the military historians who were writing about the battle of Bastogne, during the Battle of the Bulge, right afterwards, were also attributing, you know, saying it was providential, which means the hand of God was on them. And that to me seems like an important theme today as we're moving into a more and more secular world, to go back and remember a tradition that stretches from George Washington praying in the snow at Valley Forge to the soldiers praying through Christmas time. This siege happened over Christmas time in 1944. In the snow, troops without proper equipment getting gangrene in the foxholes, going to Christmas Eve services thinking they were all going to die the next day.
Tell us the significance of the siege at Bastogne.
The context of the battle, George, is the Battle of the Bulge, which occurred began on December 16, 1944, when Hitler, at the end of the war, tried this massive counterattack, a surprise panzer-led tank attack out of the Ardennes Forest in Belgium, which is the area the Germans had, since World War I, been breaking through to get to Paris. And the objective of the Battle of the Bulge, Hitler's walked on Rhine, it was a, you know, watch on the Rhine code word for this offensive, was to get to Antwerp, where our supplies were now coming in as the troops moved towards Germany from Normandy, cut off U.S. supplies, isolate troops, U.S. troops, and hopefully win a negotiated settlement to World War II where the Nazi regime could stay in power. And the key to this battle, the key to the German counteroffensive, was speed. The Nazis were going to run out of fuel if they didn't quickly achieve their objective of getting to Antwerp. And if Eisenhower and the Americans had time, you know, the Allies would have organized a defense to Bastogne, a defense of the entire battle, that would have probably pushed the Germans back long term. But in the first hours of the battle, General Eisenhower and General Bradley decided that they were going to hold this little tiny town in Belgium, Bastogne, because it was a crossroads town. It had like 8 roads passing through it. Mm-hmm. So if you want to make a quick run like the Germans did to the Meuse River out of the Ardennes, you really had to go through Bastogne. And Patton, was realizing this as well. His Third Army was positioned south. He was out of the battle range when the battle started. But the whole focus of the Allies was, we've got to hold Bastogne. And if they held Bastogne, Eisenhower figured that he could slow the Germans down and then turn the tide in the Battle of the Bulge. The problem was there were very few seasoned troops. We'd just been through slugging our way from Normandy into just at the edge of Germany on the Rhine, and the offensive, the Allied offensive was stalled. We had some very fierce battles, and we were pretty much in winter quarters, mm-hmm. hoping to replenish the troops, like the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne, which were in bivouac, in camp, in France when the battle started.
Were the troops demoralized, our troops?
Well, initially when the attack occurred, the defense of the Ardennes, which was organized by General Middleton and his 8th Corps, was largely green troops coming in and some units that had been in the battle, like the 28th Infantry, but were badly decimated and were kind of in a holding position. So when the Germans came out of the Ardennes, our troops were largely overwhelmed. Many of the units ran out of ammunition. They simply, it was complete surprise. This was a true brilliant move by Hitler in that we were not prepared. The Allies were not prepared for the Battle of the Bulge to begin. So yes, the troops running away were largely dazed and demoralized, but the call came to the 101st to get ready to go into battle. Now the 101st was had been badly depleted, fighting from airdrop, one of the first units to go into Normandy in D-Day, all the way through Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, which was a campaign organized by Montgomery, General Montgomery of the British, that had not succeeded. And the 101st was looking forward. They're going to play football games with the different regiments starting on Christmas. They look forward to getting some rest and going on, leave to Paris. This was a nice time. Suddenly, the call comes in, one morning in December 17th, you better get ready. December 17th, you better get ready because this unit is going to move out tonight. Well, the 101st didn't have any, winter equipment, no winter overcoats, no winter boots. They didn't even have complete weapons. They were being resupplied. And so the 101st, when they got this order to move out, the commander was actually, General Maxwell Taylor, was back briefing the Pentagon, and the officer in charge was the artillery commander, an older gentleman. He was 46. That was considered old in World War II. Anthony McAuliffe. General McAuliffe was the one in charge. And McAuliffe basically said through the 17th and 18th, beginning the 18th, you better get these troops ready. Men instantly said, we're going back into battle. They dropped everything. They got everything they could to camp, supplied as best they could, totally unprepared for winter. And they piled into these open trucks, steel-sided open trucks that had no cover, brought in just from everywhere. These trucks were hauling supplies in from Normandy. They were the Red Ball Express, driven by African-Americans largely. The army and military in the United States was still segregated in World War II. But these truck drivers very valiantly dropped everything they had, just rushed into Camp Mermelon to take about 11,000 men from the 101st and drive them north.
Wow.
Through this winter weather, in the middle of the night largely, with the troops not even really knowing where they were going.
My father was at the Bulge, Jerry. He was 21 years old. 21 years old, just a kid.
Right. It's incredible, isn't it, George? I mean, as they drove through that night, the 101st, heading toward what they first thought was they were going to go to a town called Verbamont. Of course, the troops really didn't know where they were going. The 28th Infantry was retreating, and it was clogging the roads. And these roads were not highways. These were really dirt roads through the Ardennes, cold, winter, snowy, very difficult to get by, and they were clogged with the retreating 28th. Well, the 28th was saying, basically, there's Nazis up there, panzers everywhere, millions of them, you're all going to get killed, you better go back. And the 101st said, well, that's why they're sending us in. We'll take care of it. I mean, the 101st did not feel fear. I mean, this is Screaming Eagles Division. This is one of the best units America has, one of the most historically decorated units in American military history. It's right now the unit that President Obama has over in Liberia fighting Ebola and coming out of Fort Campbell's, where their headquarters are in the United States and Kentucky. Well, the 28th, as they were heading into that night into camp from Camp Mermelon, heading north into Bastogne on these little roads, said to the men, well, if you're not using that carbine, I'll take it. How about that overcoat?
Hold on, Jerry. We're going to come back, talk more about this incredible story. No greater valor. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jerry Corsi with us. We're talking about his latest work, No Greater Valor. Jerry, most of your books are pretty darn dramatic, either political or conspiratorial, like the Kennedy book that you wrote, very thought-provocative. This one was about a war and a battle. How come you did this?
Well, George, the battles fascinated me, the Battle of the Bulge, and particularly the defense of Bastogne, because it really represented a small group of American troops that held this little town in Belgium during the 70 years ago, December 1944, against the Nazi last major massive counteroffensive panzer attack out of the Bastogne. And since I was a kid, the battles fascinated me. The soldiers went in the 101st Airborne Division, elements of the 10th Armored Division. Bitter cold, no proper winter equipment for most of them, gangrene in their feet from the trench foot, and just terrible conditions, running out of ammunition. And it seemed to have an element of a miracle in it, that the way the battle proceeded, even the historians at the time said it was providential, the decisions made. It was like the hand of God was on this battle. It was a great battle where, you know, faith, Judeo-Christian values seemed to drive the troops to another level of inspiration, fighting Nazi Germany, which they knew and perceived to be truly evil. And the story of this battle and how it was fought, I think, is a testament to the American strength, American courage, the moral conviction that we have had as a nation. And I hope that, again, we can celebrate in this 70th anniversary of the battle and preserve in a tradition that stretches back to George Washington and praying in the Stone Valley Forge.
Jerry, as you were doing the research for the book, No Greater Valor, did you come across anything historically about the battle that you didn't know before?
Oh, many things, George. I mean, I've researched this book now for years and have gone through the archives at College Park. I've gone to Fort Campbell archives. I've gotten pictures. Created a website as well, nogreatervalor.com, in which there's some premium. We're offering the maps and pictures from the battle free to those who buy it. I found that, you know, the decisions made all the way through the battle were just seemingly the right decisions, even though there was no real reason for it. I mean, General McAuliffe, who was heading the 101st, he was the artillery commander, in command because the division commander was back briefing the War Department when the battle started, had the intelligence as the units were preparing to pull out the 101st from Camp Mermelon in France on December 18th, he decided, 1944, he'd just gotten a command truck and headed, where they thought they were going to Verbemont, another town in Belgium, and as he drove forward as fast as he could in his command car to get to Verbemont, he wanted to see it, which was, you know, extremely important. That you get there is one of the number one rules of success at anything, and see it yourself so you know what you're dealing with. And they got close to Verbemont, and McAuliffe said, look, General Middleton, the corps commander, is in Bastogne. Let's just take a detour. We're ahead of the troops. We've got some time. Let's go see Middleton in person so I can one-on-one find out what the battle is about. Again, another important decision. He wanted to see it with his own eyes and hear it firsthand. And when he got there, Middleton says, General, I'm sure happy you arrived because you've been reassigned. Your unit is not going to Verbemont. You're coming here to Bastogne. Just, you know, providential. Was it? He did that only because he wanted to see Middleton in person. Well, they had to redirect the entire 101st on the road to get it to Bastogne instead of Verbemont. But it was that type of decision that General McAuliffe seemed to make throughout the battle that turned the tide of that battle, because it could have gone easily. The Americans should have lost. I mean, the German panzer divisions had overwhelming strength at various points in this battle. They had the initiative of surprise, and it was, you know, just a one decision this way or the other that Middleton and McAuliffe made to get the right troops and plug the line where the Germans were advancing in the first hours of the Battle of Bastogne, the Siege of Bastogne, that saved Bastogne. Had those decisions not been made, the position at Bastogne could easily have been overrun by the Nazis.
And if it was overrun by the Nazis, what would have happened for the outcome of the war, if anything?
Well, certainly it would have. Hitler's objective in the Battle of the Bulge was quickly, as fast as he could, to break through the American lines and head toward Antwerp in the north, the port. And by holding Bastogne, critical hours were gained, critical days. The Battle of Bastogne really started on the 16th of December. Well, the 101st was deployed into the battle on Monday, the December 18th, and held Bastogne through the 25th of December, really a week. General Marshall, S.L.A. Marshall, who wrote the initial history of the battle, wrote the 8 days of Bastogne, because on the 26th, Bastogne was relieved by General Patton swerving the Third Army in an historic forced march north to relieve Bastogne. And the story I also tell in the book, No Greater Valor, because it's a great story. And these 8 days through Christmas time were critical, because when Bastogne held, it was one of the key elements in breaking the back of this final German offensive. And it actually made winning the war easier, because now the major German forces were out in the open. It turned out to be a truly tactical blunder by Hitler to do this counteroffensive.
Did a lot of German troops toward the end just surrender, put their arms down, and call it quits?
Many of the troops, like some of the Volksgrenadier, the infantry, the people's divisions that went in, anybody who could fight in Germany left. I mean, older men, younger boys, not trained. The units were not, including the panzer divisions, were not what they were by any means, going back to 1938 or 1939 when, you know, the origins of World War II, when Hitler's army, before he attacked Russia, was really at its peak. But these were still very dangerous units, George. I mean, a panzer division, even if it wasn't at its peak performance, was not a unit you could take lightly, and especially the 101st going into battle, this was not a tank division. I mean, these were paratroopers who had been trained to be behind enemy lines, but, you know, they had enough artillery to stage a defense, but had it not been for units like the 10th Armored, one regiment of the 10th Armored got through, the 101st would have lacked any tanks or anti-tank, you know, vehicles to stem the German advance. And so you're basically dealing with panzer charges from the Nazis followed by infantry coming at you, and you've got maybe an M1 to defend yourself, maybe a bazooka, I mean, hopefully some artillery. And it was the artillery which turned the battle, and that's, again, one of the truly great elements why McAuliffe, an artillery commander, just by accident happened to be in charge of the division.
Jerry, how important was Patton coming in at the end?
Patton was very important. The Third Army, Patton throughout this battle, Patton's first reaction at a great conference they held in Verdun with the generals as the battle was getting going, Patton said to Eisenhower, why don't we just let the Germans run all the way to Paris? We'll cut them off and kill them all. Well, General Eisenhower said, no, George, we're not going to do that. We're going to stop them now. Patton had decided he would turn his Third Army. The Third Army was preparing to attack Germany south of Bastogne in the Saar elements of Germany. And Patton immediately changed his mind. He didn't want to be left out of this battle. He said, I'll turn the Third Army north and march it into Bastogne immediately. And Eisenhower said, well, when can you start, George? He said, I start in 48 hours. Well, they all thought Patton was crazy.
Sure.
Because this is moving an army, you know, all the divisions of an army. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, not just a division, which is 10,000 men, but maybe like, you know, four divisions, moving four divisions north, 50,000 people, with all the supplies. And Patton had it logistically figured out in his mind. So with a telephone and his command staff, two or three top staff, he pulled the whole thing logistically off and got the Third Army moving north. Now, the Third Army, we had to slug its way north, and I tell that story in terms of how difficult it was, and Patton desperately wanted to break through to relieve Bastogne on Christmas Day in 1944, and he missed it by one day. He got there the December 26th, and of course, McAuliffe and the 101st were holding out, and as long as they could get air resupply, which through the first days of the battle, was the weather was socked in, there was no air resupply, another key element of the battle. By the time Patton got there, General McAuliffe said, you know, General Patton, I'm certainly happy to see you, even though McAuliffe had maintained all of his life that he didn't need to be relieved. He had the battle fully in control, he always argued. But yet, through the battle, even though at different times there were the Germans diverted units and tried to go around Bastogne, he was still, General McAuliffe of the 101st, were still facing overwhelming German opposition at any time during the battle, could have been overrun.
It's amazing to think that it was 70 years ago, Jerry.
It is, George.
My gosh.
And so many of the men and and women who fought in this battle are passing away now. There are very few left, and they truly are great heroes. And it was, one of the distinguishing factors in my life, I got to know some of them. And my father and others, my father was not at Bastogne, but many of his friends were. And I've heard about this battle since I was a child and really devoted several years to studying it. I'm a political scientist by nature. I'm not a military historian by training, but I managed to, master as much as I could, the various after-action reports. I went to the original material in the archives. You can see much of the original material, which we're giving away as premiums on nogreatervalor.com. And even the original maps, I found the original in-color maps done immediately after the battle. At Fort Campbell, I found almost 200 photographs from the battle, many of which have never been seen. We put as many as we could in the book. But also, if you buy the book as premiums, you can free access these other original source materials. I wanted people to be able to see it with their own eyes, the original material from the battle, done during the battle, immediately after the battle. I can't emphasize enough that, the 101st, whose division history in World War II is rendezvous with destiny, how these brave troops really did pull off almost a miraculous victory at Bastogne that stretches back to Thermopylae. The defense small group holding out against massive numbers in opposition, and yet doing so with tremendous valor.
Jerry, who was the Angel of Bastogne?
Well, there was a woman who was the nurse in Bastogne. That's a great story. She was a Belgian lady from the town who came on back, and she was in the town. She was not specifically trained as a nurse to be, in terms of her profession and background, but she had nurse training. And so when the battle started, one of the key elements was that the 101st had a surgical hospital, was one of the best first surgical hospitals set up in paratrooping, the U.S. history, and it was overrun in the first days of the battle. It had been stationed to the west of Bastogne, which, was considered initially to be a safe area because the Germans were advancing from the east, but it was overrun by the Germans. All the soldiers, all the wounded, the surgeons, all the medical supplies captured. So in Bastogne, they were really trying to scramble to get any kind of medical they could. Well, the medical was gone. Now, all that unit, the surgical unit, was captured. So this nurse was recruited in and brought into the battle at that later point. Now, the key about the wounded in Bastogne, and by the way, this is dramatized in division, the Band of Brothers is about one of the units that Easy Company that fought in the Battle of Bastogne of the 101st Screaming Eagles.
And there are not many left, are there?
There are not many left, and it's dramatized in terms of the hospital that was set up in the town after the field unit hospital, the surgical hospital, was captured. The Nazis bombed Bastogne when McAuliffe refused to surrender. A vicious bombing, Christmas Eve and Christmas bombing. And the hospital, the building in town that was the hospital, had a direct hit on it with a bomb from one of the Nazi airplanes, and that building collapsed. And all the wounded, all the surgeons, this woman who was called the nurse, it was the angel of Bastogne, was killed. They were all killed. One of the huge tragedies is not only did the wounded throughout the battle have virtually no medical supplies, no surgeons to operate to help save their lives, but most were killed anyway as the hospital collapsed from a direct hit from a Nazi bomb. And this woman who had been the angel of Bastogne, had been known to save so many men, was killed when the hospital collapsed. It was a great tragedy.
It was a great Christmas for those in 1944, wasn't it, Jerry? Jeez.
It really was, George. I mean, and I tell the story about some of the chaplains who were there, one called Parachute Padre, who was known to have came in and a priest who fought with the unit from D-Day on, was ultimately captured and made a POW during the siege of Bastogne. But Christmas Eve services were held all across the line, so that men in the foxholes or little building, any building they could find, and they were holding services that evening. And the men did come to the services and very solemnly kind of said goodbye to each other that night. Kind of a calm descended over the battlefield. The men thought that they were really didn't know if they were going to survive Christmas. And the Germans had one of their most vicious attacks on Christmas Day. The Nazis were furious that General McAuliffe refused to surrender. We want to tell that story specially, but that is the story when General McAuliffe ultimately said nuts to the Nazis. He had an ultimatum to surrender, and he said, nuts, I'm not going to do it. He wrote, actually, nuts is his one-word answer, which was probably the most famous one-word command ever uttered in World War II. General Patton said, any general that eloquent, I'm going to relieve.
Well, interesting take on all that. So after the battle, what happened, Jerry?
Well, after the battle, General Patton did break through on the 26th, day after Christmas, and this was the turning point in the Battle of the Bulge, because now Bastogne had held, the Germans did not advance to Antwerp, and the units of the Germans were now exposed open in the field, trying to retreat to get back into Germany. American soldiers had enough time, Eisenhower, Bradley had enough time to bring in reinforcements, and now with Patton surging north, we were on the offensive. So starting on the 26th of December, the battle turned entirely, and we began our final push of the Nazis back in across Germany. And that was the beginning of the end of World War II in Europe.
Just, Jerry, it is just amazing what Americans did during that time period to defend our way of freedom.
Well, George, when you read it, I tried to capture as much of it as I could in the, No Greater Valor, the book, to show you what the American soldiers went through. It really made a deep impact on me, reading the stories, reading the individual accounts of soldiers. I mean, here you have troops that came into battle without winter equipment, and this is a bitter, bitter winter.
Oh my God.
There's foxholes.
Yeah. It's freezing. Jerry, stay with us. I can't believe the hour's up already. We'll come back more. And look, if you happen to have served during World War II, check in with us. Or if you have a question for Jerry, we'll take your calls next.